Good afternoon. You're on the Postman Show with Ricky Lynn and Ben Vigin. And our guest today is going to be Vinnie Eastwood, who will be on with us in probably about 60 seconds. And once he's on, we'll have problems turning him off because that's what he's like. He's like a never-ending battery. Just goes on and on and on and on. That last song, obviously, was Matthew Robinson's Scorched Earth. Matthew runs the MyFi art program up at the King Edward's building, so if you're looking for something for your kids to do and you don't want them to play Space Invaders or anything that will chew their brain out, Matthew's the man to go and see. And one last little point I'll turn around and note was that they actually had on the Green... It's been interesting about this protest is all the little bits of information that are now starting to fall out of the network to kind of give us an idea about what we're up against in the mindset. And apparently there's a little piece there about the fact that Americans have been actually, the New Zealand Armed Forces have been using the Americans to spy on New Zealand journalists that they consider to be subversive. So, there you are, I'm officially on the wanted list. Mind you, there is a reason why the New Zealand SAS do refer to me as that bastard. But in that point, let's carry on and introduce someone that they would really consider to be a bastard. Vinnie Eastwood from the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Good morning, Vinnie. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can indeed hear you well and clear.
How are you there, Vinnie?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, but I just need to... Just hear, right? Sorry, my microphone just needs to be turned up a wee bit there on my ears.
Alrighty.
Can you turn up the volume on my ear on this?
Yep.
Sorry, Vinnie, we're just going to turn up the little technical issue there with my earphones, and we'll have you talking away in just a second.
Oh, don't worry, man. You know, I get on
gotcha.
Whistleblowers and
gotcha.
And things like that.
All
I know
good.
All about technical issues. You know, not every technical issue is a conspiracy. It's like in Mecca, whenever a water pipe bursts, they blame Israel instead of just blaming their own incompetence.
Yes, well, that was definitely my own incompetence this morning. Nothing to do with any waterworks.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, Vinny, we're gonna talk about all sorts of things today. But just what I want to very briefly ask you is, you were up at the GCS protest in Auckland yesterday. How was the turnout?
Oh, it was thousands, mate. I'd say anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000.
Yeah, I thought it'd be a fairly large number because you know when the media start referring to thousands and said that you know that there were a lot of people because normally they go if there's 100 protesters they'll tell you that there's 10.
Well, if 1,000 protesters they tell you if there's 100. If they say there's thousands of protesters, there's very many thousands of protesters.
And who were the main speakers up there?
Oh, we had. In fact, if I refer back to my computer. There were a number of speakers. Jane Kelsey, Professor Jane Kelsey from the University of Auckland, talking about the TPPA. And the video's up now on YouTube. I managed to stay up until about 4 o'clock in the morning to get these really important videos out there. Because this kind of information is long form, okay? Like it can't be described in an audio nibble, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You need a whole chomp, not just a bite.
Yeah. So
hey,
we've got Kim.com.
Yeah.
Dr. Rodney Harrison QC. And Jane Kelsey, those are the ones that I've gotten up so far. A number of other speakers like Bomber Bradbury and Mike Treen from Unite Union and John Minto from Mana.
That's what I liked about the protest down here was that, it wasn't just a case of the usual suspects. You know, we had the mayor of Dunedin turned out. We had a number of mayoral candidates. It was very much a both suit and tie and casual approach in terms of it was very much a mainstream protest. And this, you know, we had 600 people turn up in Dunedin, which we're not as big as Auckland, but that for us, that's a very large turnout indeed.
Well, yeah, and in Palmerston North there was nearly 1,000 people as well, and I interviewed the head of the Palmy Panthers last night, just a quick emergency interview, and that video is up on my YouTube channel now as well. For those of you listening live, the channel is Mr. News Guerrilla Media, if you just search Vinnie Eastwood on YouTube, you should be able to find the channel relatively easy. The news reported, I think TV3 reported, this is what really gets me, okay. Protesters clash with police around New Zealand and bottles and rocks were thrown at them in Palmerston North. Okay, now, you were at the protest in Dunedin. I presume no clashes with police.
There were no clashes with the police. It was actually endorsed by the mayor of Dunedin. So
I was talking to the person who was at the protest in Napier. No clashes with police. And we saw the footage of the protest in Wellington. No clashes with police. And I spoke to the person who organised the Palmerston North protest. No clashes with police. Or bottles thrown or rocks. They made it up. This is how they start the story, to demonise all of the protesters. Isn't that brilliant? Hey, the first thing we say is they clashed with police and they threw bottles and rocks to them. Suddenly, the moronic public of New Zealand, and I'm sorry to say that, but it's the truth, believe it. They believe that the protesters are violent.
They, well, you know, they do like to be spoon-fed. But I'm just going to backtrack there a wee bit. Like, with your YouTube hits, and I'm going to, in a second we'll just get people to tell a little bit about yourself, but with your YouTube hits, at the moment, your news section, I believe, is getting more hits than TV3, MediaWorks, and TVNZ combined. Is that correct?
If you add the New Zealand Herald TV as well, which is the second most popular YouTube news channel in the country, I'm beating the pants off them as well.
It's pretty amazing. Like, just to give people a bit of a background on you, like, with the Vinnie Eastwood Show, you broadcast, at the moment, is it 12 to 2 that you're going out every day?
It's a time zone thing, so... The show has a network in America called American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. A number of years back, they gave me this slot. Now, the thing about time slots is that, in fact, I'm getting ahead of myself. At the moment, it's winter, so it's 10 a.m. till midday, and then when it goes through summer, it'll be midday till 2 p.m. Because, you know, when our time zone changes, it pushes it back an hour. And when their time zone changes the next time, then it pushes it back another hour. So it's on at different times during the year.
So for a loudmouth like you, that must be a hell of an audience. What are you going out to, about 22 states in the USA each time you do your broadcast?
26
states.
Stations in the United States. And there's a number of different internet radio stations, like in England and Ireland, that rebroadcast my show. Nine Brave stations in New Zealand, iFinity FM.
The least said about them, the better.
What are they called? Rush FM in Hamilton, yeah. and Tauranga now, and Raglan, and yeah. Also Dagsy FM up in Whangarei or Whangarei, I think.
That's pretty amazing. Now, give people an idea about your show. Like, people come on and listen to your show. They're not going to hear the standard gardening views or the very conservative outtake on the world. What you do is would be unkind to say that you're ultra-fringe?
Well, in a time of universal deceit, to tell the truth is a revolutionary act, a great man named Thomas Jefferson once said. And all I'm doing is being revolutionary by telling the truth. And my primary concern is activists, really. And people don't understand what an activist actually is. I consider them to be doing a slightly more important job than myself, or at least a harder job than myself. They're reading convoluted documents. They're breaking apart legislation. They're emailing the politicians. They actually affect real change. And what my concern was is that people don't know who these activists are, and they don't know what they do. And currently I've had nearly 300-ish activists from New Zealand on my show talking about a range of different issues. Any big story that you could ever conceive of in the media... Right, from the Rena disaster to the Christchurch earthquake to the super city to any of the draconian legislation that's been passed through Parliament, has 10,000 times as much information that is kept from the public, from that mainstream media news source, as you will hear on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. 10,000 times. That's just being conservative. Because they just leave out everything that's really important, because most of it's really controversial, honestly.
I mean, on your show, you cover subjects which I myself, just in the way that I am, doesn't mean I'm right or wrong, sometimes I think, you know, like, for example, you've dealt with issues such as, you know, alien issues, UFOs, New World Order. But, you know, that's the kind of the point, isn't it? You're giving everybody a platform, to giving people a chance to turn around and say, well, look, this is what these people think. They've gone away and spent thousands of hours researching it. They may have different viewpoints, but they're quite intelligent and they're very elegant. And here's an opportunity to hear what they say, and you can judge for yourself. Is that kind of in the style of your philosophy?
Yeah, basically, it's summed up in the phrase, everybody's got a story, and I'm in the business of making sure that those stories get heard.
And you do it in such a way, which is what I also like about your show, is that it's done in a very light-hearted manner, so that even if you don't necessarily agree with everything that's said on your show, you always walk away, A, entertained, and B, you know, educated or you know, stimulated, even if it's not necessarily you agree with 100% of what you're saying. And a lot of time, you know, you've had guests on your show that, you know, that they don't necessarily fit with what you believe in the world, but you're very keen to make sure that they get a viewpoint, aren't you?
Well, I mean, if you don't agree with somebody, it's because you haven't listened enough yet. In the most part, isn't it?
Indeed.
You know? Like if you listen to a National Party person for a long period of time, you actually begin to agree with a lot of the things that they say. However, if you have more information, you realise that although they believe the things that they say, and technically some of the things that they say are correct, they're leaving out the important issues. Like for example, privatisation of assets. If this were an ideal world, I would actually agree with privatisation of state assets. Unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world. We live in a new world order. And anybody who comes in to sell off these assets is working for the new world order. They're trying to sell across strategic resources to evil, giant, scumbaggery agents of the new world order. And it happens every single time. Even the World Bank came out with a 111-point plan of how to privatize people's countries so that basically your democracy can be privately owned and operated by offshore interests, which will be able to dictate all of your legislation, such as the GCSB bill, which is being dictated to us through the NSA, which about 60% privately owned, according to some sources.
Well that's one of the points I made in the speech that I did yesterday, was I said, you know, people don't seem to understand that with the GCSB, the main facilities are actually run by officers of the NSA, which is a foreign intelligence service.
And Kim.com revealed at the protest that the NSA has officers inside the GCSB building.
But Pete, this is on Wiki. I mean, again, I mentioned this on the protest yesterday. I mean, this has been, and Nikki Hager's made reference to this, John Pelcher has made reference to this. It's revealed in the US Embassy's own documents via WikiLeaks. What I also found quite interesting is today it was revealed that the New Zealand Defence Department is using the US Army to spy on journalists who they consider to be subversive, which, you know, I find that just quite amazing. When I look at myself, the New Zealand Defence Department quite often turns around and uses these giant, you know, aircraft guys to fly New Zealanders to peacekeeping mission, and the aircrafts themselves are known finances of terrorists themselves, or they'll support somebody like Radiola. They're given a Defence Industry Award. Radiola are cited again in the US Embassy's own documents via WikiLeaks as providing, this is a New Zealand company, providing equipment to the warlords of Sudan to carry out genocide.
I've got a quote of myself. Think about everything you've ever been told by an official source, whether that be the military, doctors, lawyers, the judiciary, the parliament, companies, whatever. Whatever their stated intention is, it's the exact opposite in reality.
Well, that's PR for you. That's the spin, spin, spin.
It's George Orwell once said that journalism is about printing what people do not want you to print.
And the rest is propaganda.
The rest is public relations.
Yeah, that's
public relations was invented by a guy named Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He was the person who actually popularized the idea of bacon and eggs. He was the person who got a whole bunch of suffragettes to smoke during a protest in order to get women to smoke, and well, that, smoke they did.
Well, that adds a whole new meaning to the word product placement, really, doesn't it? Just going to go back to this whole issue about the New World Order, because, again, you know, for people who aren't familiar with what the New World Order actually is, it's not even about a conspiracy theory. That numerous politicians, prime ministers around the world have often made reference to the New World Order. I myself, however, have always stayed clear from that word. I believe I can use words like make reference to the 1% or the global elite or the military industrial complex, which are words that people, they understand it. It means exactly the same thing, but it's in a language which I deliberately couch, because I know that if I use words like the New World Order, or dare we say it, the Illuminati, you know, a lot of time people's intellectual blinkers go up, and they're not actually hearing the message, they're just hearing the buzzword.
Yeah, well, I've got this philosophy that if you can say something over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, people begin to believe it.
Yeah.
So if you don't say New World Order and over and over and over and over again, people will never believe it because you're too afraid to say it. Well, and at the GCSB protest, no one, and I mean no one, mentioned the New World Order or the projected agenda for a tyrannical one-world government.
Well, and we'll get to that in a second too. But, you know, what I found interesting is, you know, towards the end of the protest, we had David Carter from Labor got up and he, you know, we had a variety of speakers that all spoke eloquently. They all had relevant points to make. And so at the end, you know, David Carter got up and said, oh, you know, we have to be careful that we don't make this a fringe issue. And my attitude was, no. You know, everybody that had something to say yesterday was important, and everybody walked away with a viewpoint and information that they did not have beforehand. How could that possibly be bad?
Yeah, well, the thing is, people don't feel comfortable. And somebody told me yesterday, you know, Vinny, you've got to say things in a way that people are prepared to hear. Let me tell you something. Nobody, and I mean nobody, is prepared to hear everything that they have been brought up to believe in their entire life, everything they've ever been working towards, is a lie. Nobody is prepared to hear that. Nobody is prepared to hear the fact that there is a world government being set up behind closed doors.
Well, you know,
it's now coming out into the open, and nobody wants to hear the fact that they are planning to exterminate almost all of us.
And we'll get to those cheerful subjects in a second as well, but you know, going back to like this, well, the, you know, we're agreeing with you to point, is that on the front benches of both the main parties, Labor, Greens, National, you'll find that on that front bench, that basically most of the people that sit on those front benches belong to an organisation known as Parliamentarians for Global Action, used to be called...
There's only two requirements for Parliamentarians of Global Action. One is you have to be an elected member of a government in a democracy, and the other is you have to pay by credit card.
Yep, and this is a UN-based organisation that actually have as its charter a centralised government, a centralised economy, centralised legislation. In other words, it is a blueprint for a one-world order. You know, and this is why it used to be called Parliamentarians for a world order.
Yeah, and you have a look at the conferences. They're like, how to promote sustainability in your country. And sustainability means the eradication of all freedom, basically, in a nutshell. And these kind of conferences happen all over the world, different countries, and they're all hosted in incredibly ritzy, glamorous hotels.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you have these organisations that are, you know, very, very elite, very glitzy, very glamorous, but, you know, they do cover the representatives of our parliament. You know, you've got left-wing, right-wing, centre, and they're all part of this one organisation. Another thing about, you know, Parliamentarians for Global Action is you, when you sign up to it, you actually acknowledge that, you put that organisation above your obligations to your own electorate. That's a requirement to be a member of this organisation.
Okay. So you're required to be elected democratically, you're required to pay by credit card, and you're required to reject and put below this organisation the people who elected you democratically.
And of course, when you turn around and you look deeper into the rabbit hole, you find that, you know, even though this is a UN-based organisation, you know, most of its financing is actually coming from, you know, when you follow the money trail, which is, you know, what journalism is always about, they're coming from basically large multinational corporations. So you've got elected people that are effectively saying, we're willing to turn around and put the interests of big business over and above those, the people who actually put us in office in the first place.
Yeah, and this isn't to say that business is bad. This is to say that both business and government have become corrupted.
Well, it's about an issue of transparency, isn't it? I mean, I bet you most of the people that are members do not evidently put that fact on their websites.
No, well, they're too afraid. And then this occurs to me. I ambushed a guy on Air Spinner, or Lion News Spinner, as I call him, and we were talking about the Super City. And I said, look, mate, you never reported that it is actually a requirement of law to have a binding public poll for any local government changes. And the government threw that out. And you never even reported that simple fact that the government's breaking its own laws in order to get the super city in. And the super city is 100% lifted from a UN document called Agenda 21. Almost all of our legislation for the past 20-odd years lifted directly out of Agenda 21.
Now, Agenda 21 is it's a policy or program which a lot of time gets slagged off by people saying, "Oh, look, that's conspiracy theory, rah rah rah." But you know, at the end of the day, we have conferences like the Conference on Global Warming, the Rio Conference on Global Warming 1995, ratified by over 80 countries, including New Zealand. Thank you for the correction. But you know, that document actually stated that one of its goals was to see the reduction of the world's population to 2 billion by the year 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're at 7 billion right now, so you do the math. And at the end of the day, again, also things like you don't necessarily have to believe that they're going to be marching us into Auschwitz to see this being occurring. You know, via the policies of sterilisation, ensuring that certain countries do go through economic plight, which means that they're going to starve. There's a whole number of ways that you can actually cause genocide, and that's what it actually is, without actually having
really
to do it.
There's really only one measure that you need to do, and that's another UN document called Codex Alimentarius.
Yeah.
Essentially, what it will do is outlaw vitamins. It will, in fact, it says that vitamins will be officially classified as toxins, and toxins will be officially classified as vitamins. Organic food will be outlawed, and GMO food from Monsanto will be the only source of food. And these have been known to cause cancer, sterilization, giant tumors. The tumors on the rats were so big that the rats were literally dragging their tumors behind them along the floor kind of thing. Okay? And the projected death statistics from just the vitamins and minerals alone, so that people can't get over simple diseases, 3 billion. That's just taking away people's vitamins. It'll kill 3 billion people. And then you add on to that all the starvation, the sterilization. Hey, just that one piece of implemented agenda in New Zealand, it was called the Food Bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which now allows 70 different agencies to spy on us.
Not that difficult.
Including the big one.
He who controls the food controls the world.
And in contrast to that, you look at things like Jamie Oliver's The Food Revolution, it shows you how the food that is served up in American foods is legislated. So basically that they are by law required to feed them all this food, which is making them incredibly obese. And, you know, that's another way that it's going to help kill off the human population. So, you know,
heart attacks are the leading cause of death in America. You know, they kill more people than smoking. And what else was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Dig this. Here's American health policy for you. And that kind of health policy will come here too. Pizza is now officially a vegetable. You know why?
No.
Because it's got 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, and tomatoes vegetable.
Yeah. And again, you see this on Jamie Oliver's, you see what they constitute to be health food, and its requirement or something that's absolutely incredibly bad for you, but because it has 1 or 2 ingredients mixed into the additive, it then gets considered a health food, and it has to be in part of their diet.
And all the fat-free and sugar-free stuff, it's all aspartame. Aspartame was made legal by a man named Donald Rumsfeld, who people might have remember as the Bush administration, as the Secretary of Defense, saying that there were WMDs in Iraq. He was working for Bush Senior back in the late 80s, he was the one who sold them.
And you're right, there's a very famous photo of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, and it's, that is the joke. You know, they know they have weapons of mass destruction because they've got the receipts.
What time's that bank open? 8? We're going in at 9. God and country, and he's a Hitler, and whatever else, the apathetic, docile masses need to get behind. Here, look, here's the fetus. Oh, the fetus. I hate this man all of a sudden.
We just had on the show 3 weeks ago. We had Walter McIntosh, who used to work for the CIA for over 20 years, and it was interesting to point out that one of the things he pointed out was that how militarized the intelligence services actually occur, and how much he was pointing out to me, you've got people like Jimmy Carter, who president of the United States, not exactly what you call a fringe speaker, pointing out the fact that America needs to wake up because basically it has turned into a police state.
And what?
And these are very conservative people. You know, we're not talking people that have gone wearing sandals and long hair all their lives. We're talking about people that have gone to the right universities, wear their suit and ties, and now, you know, what they are is they're educated, and now they're sort of starting to wake up and go, well, you know what? When we're starting to get regularly getting tanks and soldiers in the street, well, maybe we've gone a bit too far.
Yeah, especially if you're after, like, two bombers.
Yeah.
Alleged bombers.
Well, you know, that's
shoot
all.
One of them in the throat so he can't talk.
what you're talking about there, obviously, is the Boston Marathon bombing. And, you know, one of the highlight points of that one is there is actually footage taken from one of the American syndicated television programs showing you, or you can hear very visibly in the audio, of them saying, we surrender, we surrender, we didn't do it. And this is, you know, they repeat this numerous times before you hear the gunfire actually open up. You know, this is a syndicated television, so again, not a counterculture production, putting this actually out, but yet that story doesn't get picked up and run by the other syndicated and mainstream news programs.
Yeah, it doesn't get repeated over 1,000 times, but terrorism, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, terrorism, does get repeated 1,000 times, so that people start to believe that it's real. It's not real. There is no terrorism threat. More people die of allergic reactions to peanuts. What are we going to do? Have naked body scans to see if anybody's concealing peanuts in their underpants?
Well, don't go there. But, you know, again, one of the things that I point out recently was, you know, the city of Detroit, 75% of the ambulances are decommissioned. They're in the city, you know, so you can imagine what that's doing to how many people, you know, not getting the medical treatment that they need and are dying. They're $80 million in debt. Then the Homeland Defense spends $34 billion in equipping the local law enforcement with military equipment. What to stop terrorism that's killed less people that get killed on the freeway on any given day in the United States of America?
Now, a human rights group, that was like $34 billion or something that you said that the Department of Defense spent just on like drones or something like that, right?
Yep, that was the CSI, can't remember the acronym, but it's the Center for Investigative Reporting. So they're a fairly well-known, credible, basically, journalism watchdog organization, and that was where I sourced that information from.
Okay, now, if you wanted to wipe out poverty, okay, and poverty is defined as not having shelter, not having food, not having clean water, okay, if you wanted to wipe out poverty worldwide, it would cost approximately $12.4 billion. And then here's the fracking Department of Defense making $34 billion on drones to kill innocent people.
Well, the $34 billion was actually, I mean, the $34 billion was actually going to a whole... It wasn't just drones, it was a whole range, but that was just one part of the Department of Defense. That was Homeland Security.
That's a tiny, insignificant part. The whole Department of Defense is like $1 trillion a year or something.
Oh, it's staggering. And this is the whole, you know, another point which I raised again and again during my speech was that, you know, this is not about preventing terrorism or making us safer. It's about basically making the military and military and industrial complex get richer and richer and richer.
Actually, it's because the United States is being used as a puppet by the scumbaggery internationalist globalist filth, and they're going to be the bullies of the world. They're going to be the world army. And guess what happens when one country tries to say, "No, I don't want to be part of the New World Order. No, I don't want to kill all my people by corrupting their food supply, by selling off their assets and things like that." Guess what's going to happen? You have to fight the world army by yourself.
And that is a reality. I mean, like, you know, again, very widely reported, but not been, you know, mentioned on our network news. But Monsanto just recently turned around and bought Blackwater Security, which is the world's largest private army. And we're seeing reports over and over and over again. In this age, you know, these are starting to slip into mainstream of large corporations employing these private military, effectively mercenaries, to effectively carry out genocide. But yet you don't see them calling in the UN in Nigeria or the Sudan to stop these. In fact, in New Zealand.
Guess what? David Shearer used to work for the UN, and one of the primary documents that he released while he was there is why mercenaries are good and should be used at these particular locations.
Yeah, that's right.
You just mentioned, like in Africa or something like that, where it would be more politically expedient to use mercenaries instead of a national army. And guess what? John Key did over a weekend, like I think this happened like last year around August or whatever. He goes over and he signs us up to NATO. Hold on a second. The Prime Minister of a country in the South Pacific flies to the Northern Hemisphere to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, representing a country that's in the South Pacific.
Because we know that Bulgaria is such a threat to our national security.
It's kind of a geography lesson that's missing here.
But you know, it's there's another aspect of which I pointed out was the. We currently have in our legislation, we have the anti-mercenary bill, which is in its third reading, but hasn't been presented to its third reading. This could actually prevent New Zealanders from being involved in private military contractors. And in Iraq currently, there are now over 2,000 New Zealand ex-police officers and military working there. And closer to home, the Solomons, PNG, Fiji, you've got these guys that are causing, you know, destabilisation in our own back door simply because nobody will turn around and stamp out that private military trade. Once upon a time, you were in the army, to be a private gun was to be considered dishonourable. Now it's considered a career move.
Well, they do pay you a hell of a lot better, and it's really good where you can get all that really excellent training on how to kill people, and then you get to sell your wares after the fact for a hell of a lot more money. Okay, the country paid you, the country trained you, the country bear all the costs for you, and now you get to reap the benefits.
Well, that's in Bernie Brolson's book called Soldiering On, and Bernie Brolson used to be a member of the New Zealand Special Air Service, and in his book, you know, he lets it slip that you've got these private military contractors coming into secure bases like Papakura, being given the reviews or various, you know, performance sheets by the commanding officers so that they can choose who they want to come and work for them, and then they tap them on the shoulder and say, you know, meet me outside the gates in 5 minutes and we'll have a brand new job. So we pay and train them, and then they go off and they end up being basically attack dogs for people that aren't necessarily going to do our own national security any good.
Or anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's a big, shocking festival of deceit and scumbaggery out there. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a person who has a conscience. And the problem with having a conscience is that you can't get it to shut up. So when you see people dying for no good reason, and you see people getting ripped off for no good reason, and you see the evil pieces of trash that are doing this, not only to you, but to me and to everybody else that we've ever met in our lives, I can't deal with that. So I have to do something about it. And that's the problem. I'm one of the minority who actually has that big smack in the face that goes, you know what, man? You can't be a salesman anymore. You can't make $800 a week anymore. You've got a full-time. You've got to do 70, 80 hours a week to make sure that these people's voices get heard.
And that's a good point to point and explain to people, you know, what were you doing before you kicked off the Vinnie Eastwood show, and how did you go from doing that to doing what you're doing now?
Well, my first job, my mum wouldn't let me get a job during high school for some reason, was to direct, produce, promote, and put on my own play. which was really critically acclaimed, and I got enough money to go down to university. When I got to university, suddenly with no support network around me, girlfriend left, flatmate was basically mooching off me, $3,000 down the drain or something like that. I started dealing cannabis because I was really lonely, and
you're really lonely.
People came around and that kind of thing, and I got arrested for it. Somebody dobbed me in. And I told the police everything, you know, I totally confessed. They said, yes, I've been dealing for 8 months. I've been selling about an ounce a week or whatever. And then they still made up evidence. And it was the most traumatic time of my life. And I'll never forget that, how I thought at the time that police were honest, decent people who were just trying to do right by everybody in general. But the reality is they just treated me like I was trash and lied all the time. And that really woke me up to how the world really works. And I went to uni back up in Auckland about a year or so later. I had to do 300 hours community service for possession of 13 grams of cannabis. And the guy in front of me was up for sexual assault, growing 5 plants, and resisting arrest. He got 150 hours community service. explain that one to me. And I became a telesalesman. This friend, friend of my brother's told me that I'd be really good at it. And I was. I got up to basically the top form of the company for my my last 6 months there, doing residential phone sales over the phone. You know, just telling people, you know, a competitor to Telecom. So you know how loyal people are to Telecom. I had a 50% strike rate. So for every second person that picked up that phone, I could get them to switch from Telecom to something that's a New Zealand-owned company instead. And then I got promoted, and I told them that I'm done doing sales. I've reached the top of that game. I want to do something else. I want to help people. I want to do like, but they gave me the job as business account manager, for which they gave me no business accounts to manage, because that wasn't what a business account manager was. Mm. A business account manager was simply business telesales. And so I got bored. And I wrote a 7-page essay about what was wrong with the company. All their training protocols, all their programs, faults, how to increase staff retention, how to give people something to do during breaks instead of just smoking cigarettes, and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, we had a big meeting with all the business account managers and the second in charge of the company. And then after about 12 minutes, his phone rings and he goes, "Okay, I'm sorry, I've got to go," after we get halfway through page two. And then I email him a couple of days later and say, "Hey, what's going on?" You know, because all the other business account managers and basically anybody else in the company was full on agreeing with me, because these were real obvious glaring problems. And so they said, "As far as I'm concerned, the matter is closed." And then a couple of days later, my boss comes up to me and he says, "You know, Vinny, come and have a coffee next door." And I'm like, "Yeah, sweet as, I need a coffee." And he sits me down at the cafe, slaps a piece of paper down, and he says, "Sign it." I go, "What am I signing?" He says, "Well, we're going to give you 6 weeks' pay if you'll leave." And I mean, what? Leave, like, right now? And he's like, "Yeah, in the next 5 minutes." And to never tell people this company that I was working for. And you know what, Ben, I hadn't had a summer holiday for quite a long time, so I took the $3,000, and I had a summer holiday off. And the money started to run out. And so I got another telesales job. And they started promoting me like fucking nobody's business. And then it turns out that these people were only paying me about 5% of what they should have. They were taking all the sales and everything like that that Vodafone was subcontracting on to them and keeping the bulk of it for themselves and leaving all of us out. I was actually paying to work at the end of the day. I had to pay for my own phone, my own car and stuff like that. They sent me out on the roads and everything, driving out to Otahuhu or Albany from Mount Eden and stuff like that. And with the oil prices the way they were, it's just ridiculous. I was paying about maybe $80 a week to work. And I was getting into debt, and I go into the boss and I say, "Look, I can't keep working here unless you pay me more." And they go, "Oh, well, you think you got us over a barrel." And so naturally, they decided that they would tell us to do a hell of a lot more work by entering in all the data which they were supposed to be taking care of and not pay us anymore. So most of the people left the company at that point. And formed a couple of the people there, some of the top salespeople, myself included, became part of a new company run by a real psycho. And what I noticed, and I think this is my last day, is that I was starting to listen to Alex Jones a lot and watching kind of like two documentaries a day sort of thing for about 6 months. So I had this geometric shift in my perception of reality. And I was getting really depressed. I was getting really angry. I couldn't go to work any day without getting high first. I was just absolutely dependent on it. I was just really I was really in a bad place. And it wasn't because I wasn't earning money. It was because I knew that I wasn't contributing anything good to society. And it was really irking on me because I started to see the monumental problems that we had, and I didn't think that doing telesales for a Vodafone subsidiary was going to cut it. So I quit. I called my friend John Eisen from Uncensored magazine, uncensored.co.nz, and I said to him, "You know, John, I feel like I really want to quit." And he asked me one question, I'll never forget this. He says, "Does it feel right?" I said, yeah, it does feel right. So I quit. Took my money. Last paycheck for the month was $4,000 plus $11,900 worth of Westfield shopping vouchers that was done. So, you know, I walked away from a job when my last paycheck for a month was like $15,000, okay? And I bought myself a computer, I bought myself a camera, and I went about trying to, you know, get out to protests, public meetings, filming them, editing them, no training, no nothing. You just look at a person who's speaking at a protest, person with a megaphone, person with a microphone. Those are the people you go and talk to. The news doesn't talk to those people.
Yeah.
Excuse me, is there anybody with a really unkempt beard and a moth-eaten jersey around? Oh, we'll interview that person. You know, that's basically how it happened. So as a result of doing this and speaking to these people, I realized they had a hell of a lot of knowledge, like huge quantities of knowledge. And it's been a struggle, you know, like over the years trying to just, you know, eke out a living. I did dance party videos for a bit, and eventually this has just become full-time. I've got a five-day-a-week radio show. I'm in one of the top million websites in the year just for my in the world just for my website alone. I have more YouTube subscribers than any mainstream media news channel in New Zealand. In fact, most of them you could combine together and I'd still be beating them. I am a celebrity now. When I go to protest, there's about 10% of the people who know me. Two people gave me $100 note each at the protest yesterday just to thank me for who I am and what I do. And I'm completely and utterly listener-supported because I don't know about you, bro, but I'm done being a salesman, you know?
I can't tell anything anymore.
I'm going to give people what they need, and what they need is the truth, because we need to suffer. That's what my main conclusion is about this. Without pain,
it's very Buddhist.
Without suffering, without sacrifice, we don't learn anything worth learning.
Well, you know, just sort of, you know, whimsically, you know, I do wonder about that sometimes in terms of, I look at my grandfather's generation and, you know, they do seem to have a little bit more endurance and a little bit more kind of sticking with it than this generation does. And I think it is because they did go through some pretty hard times and they learnt the value of what, you know, whereas sometimes the generation that I'm part of and you are and the ones beneath us, we're in our little bubble and we don't really challenge it too much because at the end of the day we've got our iPods, we've got our Facebook, we've got all our toys, and it's not until those things start disappearing and food, you know, vanishes off the table that I think a lot of people will really start to realise, you know, that things aren't as peachy as they first thought they were.
Well, you know, just looking around me right now, I've got a 27-inch quad-core iMac. I've got a printer that can print DVDs and scan stuff. I've got a, what's this, I think a 72-inch LCD screen. I've got a 100-watt megaphone. I've got a four-channel stereo condenser mic that plugs into the computer via USB. I've got wireless microphones to capture crystal clear audio quality sound from 50 meters away. I've got a camera that is about the size of an iPhone that shoots in full HD and has a audio jack input. Another GoPro camera, which I've got with a shoulder mount, and a number of other accessories like an LCD screen and a mic output. I've got a lighting display with four of the most gargantuan freaking energy saver bulbs that you've ever seen. It's ironic, isn't it? And I've got banners all over the place that are really well printed, like on canvas and backed by Core Flute. You know, everything that I have has been given to me. No, seriously, everything that I just listed there.
Yeah, wow.
Has been donated by a listener, like one of the people who might be listening to this show. Okay? There's only one reason why people would act with such generosity.
Because they care.
They care, okay, and that is what I have found out is the real key here. If you care, people start to care about you. If you give a fuck about the issues, then suddenly other people start to care about them too. You know, it's a reciprocal thing. And I don't let people down, invariably. I work harder than anybody else. I really do go to these public meetings. And now I'm shooting with two camera angles so that when you're watching those videos with Kim.com doing his speeches and stuff like that, it's cutting between them. It's a hell of a lot of work. and I'm not done yet. I still haven't archived my shows. I need help at this point because I think I might have been bitten off more than I can chew. I mean, if you can name me one person anywhere in the world who's gotten as much accomplished as I have by themselves, you know, point them out. I don't think they exist.
Well, I can't speak for the world, but you know, within New Zealand, you know, what you've done in a short time is pretty bloody amazing. And you know, again, it's a, you know, thought went through my head was relating to the whole issue of you know, when the TVNZ cameras or the ODT or in your case, New Zealand Herald turn up for a protest. Even though you've got all of those statistics behind you, I'm pretty damn certain they won't come up and ask you a question. And likewise, you know, down here in Dunedin, we have a gentleman called Kieran Tass, who very much a prominent person in the activism movement, was one of the leading spokesmen of the Occupy movement. Now, Kieran is a person that has worked in the finance industry for over 20 years. He knows his material. Yet when they have the ODT reporting on the Occupy movement, they don't go and talk to Kieran, even though he's one of these spokespeople. They go and talk to the crazy cat lady.
Yeah, and Ian Wishart had him on my show.
Lucky you.
it was really hard to get him, and I haven't been able to really get a hold of him for over 2 years.
Yeah.
I wish that wasn't the case, but he told me something that the media is the fourth estate.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're supposed to be here to keep check on the people in power. Those people can actually do a lot of damage, you know. One irresponsible person who is uneducated, has no money in their pocket or anything like that, they might assault somebody at a bar or something.
Yeah.
They can do that much damage to society. These other people that are not being reported on, they can destroy nations in moments.
Well, one person I think I would like you to talk a little bit about is one of the guests that you've had on your show who people really do need to know about is Vince Seema. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you just want to kind of elucidate a little bit about, you know, who Vince was and why he's so significant and where he is right now for having done what he's done?
I could actually play you a video. Of Vince Seema talking, because this is something that I found was really frustrating. I don't really have it here. I've got one of my.
Give out. Put the video up on your website and just give out your web province, and people can go and have a look at that later on, maybe.
Yeah. If you go to youtube.com/MrNews Guerrilla Media, that MR News, GUE, Rilla Media, that's the YouTube channel name. Or if you just search Vince Seema, S-I-E-M-E-R, on YouTube, you'll be able to get these videos. Now, you know, you remember the terrorism raids, right?
And, do I do. 2007, which was the same time they turned around, they did the anti-terrorism legislation, which now means that the termination of terrorism subversion is no longer defined by the Prime Minister's office, but by Washington. So, yes, I remember that those raids very, very clearly.
Exactly. Now, the Urawera 4, I believe, were put in front of Chief Justice Helen Winkleman. Chief Justice Helen Winkleman ruled that 7 out of the 9 warrants issued of those terror raids were unlawful. And then she sealed that judgment so that the media couldn't report on it. And then she denied the Urawera 4 their rights under the Bill of Rights to a jury trial, citing that the jury, I'm paraphrasing here, wouldn't come to the same conclusions as her on the case, so therefore she doesn't want a jury trial for them and completely violates the Bill of Rights. Vince Seema's crime is reporting that she committed a crime by denying these people their right to a trial. He reported the crime of a judge. He has been in jail 4 times, and he is the preeminent public watchdog.
Well, the amazing thing about Vince
in this country.
Well, he's amazing, and the thing about Vince is, you know, what he really highlights is they're not even playing by their own playbook. They're deviating from due process. It's do as we say, not as we do.
Did you know that there is no requirement to record court proceedings? how can you have a court of record if there ain't no record? And the answer is, you just can't. And why do you think they call it the criminal justice system? Because it's just criminal.
Well, I mean, I think, was it something that I heard on your show, something along the lines of, like, 42 of the top judges in this country are actually all intermarried, so...
Oh, no, it's even worse than that. There's, like, 168 top justices in this country, and I think, like, maybe 80 of them aren't related. You know? So, like, well over half of the top judges in this country are related by blood, at least first cousins.
So the significance of that is that when you go and you have a trial and you don't believe something's correct and you go for an appeal, that appeal will be reviewed by someone that is actually related. So that isn't a conflict of interest. I don't know what is.
Yeah, and in that case, Vince Seymour has said, and I'm quoting him here, New Zealand has the world's most corrupt court system. Here's why. You've got a corrupt judge in the States, and you want to file an appeal, the chances are the next judge that you go to won't have any connections to them because it's a big country.
Yeah.
It's a big place, there's a lot of people. In this country, there's only 4 million people, there's only a couple of hundred judges, and they're all frickin' related. So your chance of getting an adequate appeal by somebody who isn't corrupt, who isn't in a pocket, who isn't wearing a Masonic ring, is very frickin' low indeed.
See, what is amazing about this is that, and I don't know if it was Vince, but when I lived in Wellington in about 2000, there were a couple of guys that used to protest outside the Dominion Post every morning, highlighting, the numerous deviations from due process that our court systems were doing. Not once did the ODT ever turn, sorry, not the ODT, the Dominion Post ever turn around and do a story on these guys. And they were, they were people that had multiple degrees, they were trained lawyers themselves, they were elegantly spoken, they had something relevant to be said, but, even though they're out there every single day, not once did they get the opportunity.
Actually, I mentioned Ian Wishart before and then we went off on a tangent. This is what he said to me. He said that reporters are airheads. All right, I will say that again. Ian Wishart, one of the country's top, most respected journalists, said that the vast majority of the reporters are airheads.
The only thing
they care about is where their next Gucci handbag's coming from and when they're taking their next trip to Tahiti.
That's it.
That's why they ain't reporting on anything important, because they don't actually care.
Well, I mean, I agree with that, and I'll come to that in a second, but my own problems with, Ian actually published my first book, and he's not a guy that I actually have a lot of respect for in terms of I've seen him actually make up quotes himself in print, but that was standing, he is correct. I mean, I remember recently I went to Queenstown, I sat down at a table, I was invited over to a table of journalists, so most of the people would know these people's names, they worked for most of the major networks. I was, quite honoured in the sense that, yeah, Ben, come over, we sat down, they all knew who I was, they all liked what I was doing. But, what they basically turned around and said to me is that we like you because you do what we can't do, and we don't want to give up what we're doing because we like our platinum and expense card. They basically acknowledge that they've been given golden handcuffs and that's why they don't do the job that they're actually paid to do.
A slave in a golden cage is still a slave, is he not?
He is indeed. It's a tricky one because, again, it's not like, in terms of conspiracy theory, it's not like someone turns around and says, you can't report that story, but every journalist goes, I want to pay rise this year, and I maybe want to become the editor sometime. So by nature, they self-censor themselves and they don't take the stories to the editors that they know are going to be controversial or challenged to the paper's advertisers.
Melanie Reed, who did the story of Alan Smith, who was cured of life-threatening swine flu through the use of intravenous vitamin C.
Yeah.
And Melanie is right up there. Like, those are the two journalists that I respect most in this country thus far that have come out of the mainstream, is Melanie Reed and Ian Wishart. And what's happened is she told me that she got in a lot of trouble for running that story and doing it the way she did.
And I've seen the first thing happen. I mean, I remember I worked at one paper at one stage, and we had a friend of mine, and she was blonde, blue-eyed, and, you know, reasonably well-endowed in all the right places, and she was basically the paper's darling right up until the point that she turned around and wanted to do a story on the HIV issue in Queenstown. She nearly got herself fired and for doing nothing more than going and talking to a few doctors and doing her job. But because they perceived it as being a threat to the tourist dollars of the town, she got herself in deep trouble. And right up at that point, she'd been flavour of the month.
Mm-hmm. You know, loyalty, Ben, they don't have any. They'll stab you in the back just as soon as it's turned.
Well, you know, many lifetimes ago, I used to be the private research for Alan Jones and 2U Radio in Sydney, which is New Zealand's leading talkback radio. It was the first time that I properly immersed myself in corporate media culture, and it was the last time I walked out of that environment going, you know, seeing during the elections, during the Paul Keating, John Howard elections, and because Alan Jones was pro-John Howard, the other side wasn't even given a chance to talk. They simply, you know, didn't give them an air opportunity, and that was my wake-up to the how fair and balanced things actually are in corporate media. I also remember that there was another event that happened during that election. Was there was a guy that actually worked out how you could vote no confidence during the election. That was his crime, and he was thrown in jail for the very fact of reporting the fact that you could show you how to vote no confidence. Happened, didn't get any news coverage.
In New Zealand, it's illegal to vote no confidence, I think, as well.
Well, me and Ricky have decided that we're actually going to start up our own party. It's going to be called the Vote No Confidence Party. And that way you can have it on the form.
Well, Kale Watson is an activist up here in Auckland, along with Dean Murray and Dilip Rupa of Rupa's Cafe. Dilip Rupa took the BNZ to court. He had 20 kilos of documents to beat these people in court. They were trying to take his parents' cafe off them, kind of thing. And he found out that all the money that they were leveraging and saying that they loaned to them was BS. And so those guys got together and created the No Confidence Party website.
Oh, we would have been beaten to it, Ricky.
Yeah.
It must be a good idea.
Well, yeah, and what's interesting about the New Zealand legislation is what Kale Watson told me, is that if you are registered to vote, and it's required that you're registered to vote, of course, and you don't actually vote, then your votes are still given out by proxy to the winner anyway.
Oh, wow. Well, that's interesting in the context that John Key got elected in the last election by only 34% of New Zealanders voted for him. So according to what you're saying, a percentage of those votes will actually be people who didn't vote.
Well, actually, the vast majority of that, because what they're saying is they say, oh, only 34% of the people voted, but they count all the votes as if they had voted anyway.
The proxy votes.
Yeah, exactly. So if a majority of the people who did vote, let's say 15% of the people voted for John Key, and 70% of people didn't like John Key, didn't like Labor, didn't like the Greens, didn't like anybody, and it's basically a no-confidence vote by proxy. What they say is, well, 50% of those people are now voting for John Key. John Key wins.
Oh, yes, that's democracy for you.
It's idiocracy for you. And, you know, this country's got so much festering problems, and it's, you know, there's just not enough time in all the world. There's not enough attention span in all the country to really get all these issues out. And sometimes you feel like you're pushing Shiite Muslim uphill. But the problem is, ultimately, at the end of the day, is I'm going out there. I'm doing the work that the media should. Okay, I really am. And doing it way better than they are, given both sides of the coverage, even people that I disagree with. Okay, my opinion doesn't really matter. What matters is the information. And if the information can change my opinion on something, then I would have been very glad to have heard it, right? But the media don't think that way. And that's what's really sad is I'll put all these videos up, and they're well-edited. They've got good sound, good audio-video quality, you know. The whole ball of wax. And they get like 100 or 200 hits sometimes, you know, and it's almost heartbreaking to see that people who watch these videos and like them or something like that, don't freaking share them. I'm not sure if the audience understands just how important shows like yours are, Ben, or shows like mine. And more to the point, the fact that we don't really have quite so much of an advertising budget, and the only way that we're actually going to get out there
is when they share.
The only way that the situation is going to change, the only way for all the people to rise up together with the empowering information is if they play their part too. You can't leave it all up to us. We need you to help us, ladies and gentlemen. We can't do it alone. Even we're doing it alone because we don't really have a choice, you know?
Well, it is frustrating when you're on Facebook and you put up a post and, you know, you see a number of people come along and they like it, and you're like, I would rather you hit the share button instead of the like button, you know? And that's the bit you're trying to get through to them, is it's like, you, if you like what we're doing, then help me by, you know, telling other people about it as well. But it is also interesting in terms of, you know, one of the reasons why I sort of went down the road that I did in terms of being basically an independent media was I disagreed with what I was told by my media bosses, that, you know, said, oh, no, people aren't interested in this, they don't want it, you got to do it in this format. And I went, no, I don't think that's the case. And when I put up my first book in 99, that book sold, you know, close on 15,000 copies. It was on the best-selling list for 6 months. It, for a first-time author, smashed every single record that you care to consider. Yet didn't get a single review by any newspaper in the country, but the very figures themselves showed that there was the interest out there. And this has been the repeated story of my life. I've been smashing records since I can remember, and showing them that their format, you know, people don't want to be treated like the mushrooms. They are interested in complicated, in-depth issues.
Well, it's because people have a hunger for the truth, and you can't satisfy your hunger for the truth with a soundbite or two.
No, that's true. And that's the format that we've done, you know. And it's interesting, like, I'm 43 years of age, and when I was growing up in my 20s, you used to turn on television during the weekdays, and there was point-to-point, counterpoint, investigate, eyewitness. There were around about 7 or 8 different investigative journalism programs on. Every night, each of these guys were given a budget of about $500,000 to go off and do an in-depth investigation. The Dominion Post had their own investigation news section, which had its own on-current files, which would always be updated. Today, that is all gone, and if you're lucky, you might get $500,000 to do an entire series, which it's easier to turn around and buy something that's a reality TV because it's cheaper to make. So it's a real dumbing down by the accountants.
Yeah. Well, you know what is encouraging, though, is the amount of support that that I've been getting. And the fact that every time I'm on the bones of my ass, every time when I think I'm just about dead in the water, something will happen. And it's like synchronicity. Call it angels on your shoulders. Call it what you will. I believe.
I call it bloody-mindedness.
I just believe, essentially, that I'm here to do something that is good for humanity. And as a direct result, humanity gives me everything I need back, you know? Like, I think about a month ago, I was like, oh my God, my credit card bill's in, my internet bill's in, my rent's due, and my bank accounts are dry, and I've got no gas in my car, and the missus needs a rego for hers. It's going to cost me like $700 to get all this, and my bank accounts are dry. And then I get up in the morning, and there's a 500 euro donation in there from one of my listeners in Germany. And that's worth about $700-800.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by that myself. You know, I've been writing my paper down here for 11 years now, and, you know, Dunedin's a small town, so it's no secret that I don't drive around in a Ferrari, but it's, you know, every time when I think I've just hit the wall, it always turns up. And what I'm always really pleased about is the number of people that support what I'm doing, not because they necessarily have to, but because they just understand how hard I do work, and the fact that I'm not driven by profit, that I'm driven by the fact that I think this is essential part of our society. And if we don't have a healthy society, or we have a society which is just orientated around profit alone, I don't want to be part of that. And, you know, so because I take that stance, I do get rewards and support. I just wish sometimes people had a little bit more understanding about just, you know, how much effort it requires to do what we're doing.
Yeah, and They really don't have any idea.
It's not their fault either. I mean, most people are just trying to go to work in the morning and get on with their own lives. They don't really have enough time to kind of step outside the circle and realise, you know, to do what we're doing, how many thousands of hours go into what we're doing in any
given way. I really hate, Ben, is when I'm at a protest and somebody comes up to me and goes, why don't you get a job? Why? So I can be a slave like you? So I can go to my slave job with my slave boss telling me to do my slave work and then go home in my slave car in the slave traffic to go to drink some slave beer in my slave hovel?
It always blows me away. I mean, the highest paid job.
What are you talking about?
The highest paid job I ever had was working for Westpac as their research officer in somewhere in the 90s. It was a research officer. They were paying me $34 an hour to take one sticker off a folder and stick it on another. You know, my turnover a week was about $1,200 a week. If I'd stuck with the company, I'm sure I would have been getting paid a lot more and not really having to work that much harder. But in the end, I just turned around and went, this is not what I want to do.
Yeah, it's not exactly stimulating work, is it?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing was, I could actually get all my work done within about 2 or 3 hours, and then I could then run around and plunder the rest of Westpac's resources to make phone calls and do all sorts of things. So, you know, it was quite a fun environment to work in. I used to call them the Let Them Eat Cake Bank, because it used to be that any time that it was someone's birthday, we'd all stop work and have, additionally on top of our breaks, we'd have a sausage roll and a cake. Now, the floor I worked on alone had 600 people, so it seemed like every bloody time I sat down, it was time to get up and blow out the candles for somebody. It was a Thursday, Friday, everyone would go out to lunch and they wouldn't come back. So the whole culture was about, hey, let's pay you as well as possible so you don't really have to question too much what you're actually doing or who it's going to affect. And unfortunately, because I didn't just run around, you know, photocopying my bum on the machines, but I went and started reading some of the literature on the shelves, you know, it really made me aware of the fact, again, this is not part of a system that I wanted to be part of. I was doing okay out of it, but I could realise that I was actually helping plunder people who weren't doing anything but really working hard and trying to get ahead and just being, you know, having a system that didn't want them to go get ahead.
Yeah, well, people have given up on their dreams and because they're afraid of failure. And you know what's funny? Is if you're afraid of failure and you never try,
you will fail.
You've automatically failed. Isn't that funny? That in order to prevent yourself from feeling the feeling and sensation of failure, you ensure that you fail.
Well, I mean, to me, it's one of the best things I ever took out of, you know, I spent 6 years in the territorials, and one of the best things I ever took out of the Army was the fact that, you know, it's don't be afraid to try something and even though you think you can't do it, and don't be afraid of or how hard or dirty something gets, because at the end of it, when you do accomplish it, the sense of well-being and feeling like, hey, I did this, is worth it, you know, and that's what I think a lot of people miss out on, is it's they're afraid of actually of trying in the first place, so they never succeed.
Yeah, and this is part of the human condition. And I believe it's deliberate. It's part of a deliberate agenda through the education system and this kind of thing. They ain't training you to be entrepreneurs. In fact, you know, funny story. When I was a boy, people thought I had ADD. And my mother was given a brochure by the school guidance counselor. Had all these symptoms on it. And I found what these symptoms were, some of them were very interesting, like really creative, or highly intelligent, or unwillingness to back down. Very single-minded, very very focused sometimes, you know, and that kind of thing. And these are symptoms for ADHD. And I was like, this is really weird. And then when I was going to university, I think I was like 21, I saw those exact same symptoms on the on it projected in front of me at business school for entrepreneur personality traits.
Well, you know,
And take this, bro. This is what I reckon. People have got dyslexia, people have got ADHD, they're getting misdiagnosed as having an illness, when the reality is they've just got a different learning style that the system doesn't want.
I always say, Vinny, if you turn around, if you took everybody in society that was either schizophrenic, bipolar, ADD, dyslexic, or whatever, and you turn around and you took them all out of society, bang! 3/4 of your music would disappear. All the art in your cafes would disappear. Western society has taken these conditions and they're looking at them. They're actually gifts. But unfortunately, we look down on them and we don't channel them properly. So what could be a really good asset to our society actually becomes pushed away and these people get
It's because we're told that there's something wrong with us. There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with you. There's the world that is crazy.
Well, it's quite interesting because they recently did a paper on, you know, what you require to get to the top of to be a CEO of a major corporation, and then they matched that psychological profile up with a sociopath, and basically every single major attribute that a CEO has is the same attribute that a sociopath has.
Yeah, and psychopaths, according to the American Medical Journal, are very smiling, enchanting people when you first meet them, but ultimately don't have a whole lot of depth to their personality and don't have any long-lasting relationships. And the places you are likely to find psychopaths is in the power centers. They listed them. They are in entertainment, business, politics, law,
journalism,
medicine. No, journalism fits in there with entertainment, doesn't it?
Right, yep.
And what was the other one? Religious gurus.
Yes.
Right, now dig this. If those are the power structures of society, and you take that and you just think about that for a moment. The doctors, the lawyers, the politicians, the businessmen, the CEOs, and your religious leaders, and your entertainers, and your informers, and all the people in the media are more likely than anyone else to be a psychopath. And you think that society isn't fracking crazy?
Yeah.
There's a reason for this. There's a reason why things appear so insane. There's a reason why everybody wonders why the hell Alice in Wonderland seems so familiar to them.
Well, that's it. If you're 21st century and you're not crazy, then you really are. Sorry, if you're 21st century and you don't think you're crazy, then you really are crazy. Because with all the things going on, how can you not be bothered by this, even on a subconscious level?
Well, it's the story of the cosmic schmuck. Have you ever heard of the story of the cosmic schmuck?
No, tell me the story about the cosmic schmuck.
All right. Now, for those who don't know, a schmuck is like an idiot, you know. I think it's a Yiddish word. And if you sit there and you never question, you know, am I the cosmic schmuck? If you never question that, if you never wonder whether or not you are the cosmic schmuck, then it's far more likely that you will be the cosmic schmuck or become the cosmic schmuck. But if you're always sitting there wondering to yourself, you know, man, am I the cosmic schmuck? Then it's very unlikely that you'll become him, and it's very unlikely that you are. All right? If you don't question your sanity, if you don't question your own position, if you take things for granted, if you take things as given, you're the cosmic schmuck.
That's so true. I guess, however, what needs to be balanced up against that is, you know, when you look at, in any given week, the issues that you cover, the people you interview, and you deal with some serious subjects. I mean, you're looking at the issue of, you know, questions like, you know, are our power elite trying to actually kill off the population, the fiscal economy, the power monopolies. You know, this is all heavy, heavy stuff. How do you find a way to balance this up so that, you know, you are, A, caring, but at the same time you're not burning yourself out?
Well, I interviewed a guy yesterday called Paul Levy, and he came up with there's an archetype called the wounded healer, whereby you can't actually heal people's pain unless you've gone through it yourself.
Yeah.
You can't actually understand that pain unless you've experienced it, in other words. And what these wounded healers, they're shamanic practice going out there.
Yeah.
And they use the fact that they're damaged goods to be able to relate to other people who have suffered damage. And they actually take on the pain, they take on the trauma from all of these other people, and they bring it into themselves, and then they transmute it into something positive, something loving, something that is full of light rather than darkness, and then dispel it. And then they survive it, and the person that you draw that bad negativity out of feels better about it. And I was like, oh my God, that's what I do. I take bad stuff from people, and I get rid of the terrible, horrible nature of it by experiencing it and accepting it. I accept the fear that I have. I accept the anger that I have. And at the end of the day, the one thing that you've got to keep is a good sense of humour. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you can get friggin' nuts.
It's quite interesting because, you know, everything you just turned around and said, you know, that actually fits the very model. If you're involved in counter-terrorism, that's exactly what you mean to be doing. You know, if you want to stop terrorism, it's not actually about guns and machine guns and storming. It's actually relating to the terrorist, finding out where he's coming from, finding a common ground, and then talking him down. And it's interesting, the most successful hostage negotiation unit in the entire world are not the ones with guns and machine guns. It's actually the New York Police Department, and their motto, the New York Police Department's hostage negotiation unit, and their motto is, "We bore them to death." But basically what it is the issue of empathising, and that's sort of what you're talking about. But what I'm trying to get across is that while you're doing this and you're finding, you know, all your hurt and your fear and relating in a way that people can express and find common ground, how do you personally find ways to make sure that when you walk out of the studio at the end of the day that you're grounded, you're content, so that when you're going back into your home life that you're not taking that into your home life and you can actually enjoy the quality of life with the people that you're with?
Well, to be honest, you can't afford to separate your home life and your work life if your work life is saving humanity and living healthy.
Oh, your partner just must love you then.
Yeah, she does. She does love me, and I love her too very much. And we swap roles a lot of the time, so there'll be times when I... Like the other day I interviewed Pip Cunningham from Hamilton, and she had her daughter taken off her for frivolous reasons by SIFs. And you hear a mother's pain, and this happens to fathers as well, invariably most of the time, if they get their kids snatched by SIFs for no good reason. And, you know, I was just like, I cried during the interview, and I came out, and I was just so upset and really, really unhappy because I feel this pain that comes across from people. I have a really intense level of empathy that most people wouldn't actually be able to stand. Like, you ever seen those movies where, I don't know, somebody is suddenly psychic and they can hear everybody's thoughts, and there's so many voices, there's so many people crying out that they go insane, that kind of thing? It's like that, but I don't get driven insane by it. I've learned to just accept it and understand that my job has challenges. And at the end of the day, I get hugs, and she baked me fresh bread and some cookies, so it's all good.
Sweet. We like that. You know, support of any kind of job that's fairly intense is a fairly essential, you know, part. You do need that support. It's kind of good to know that you've actually got it.
For the first 5 years, she was basically the one paying all the bills, bro.
Well, that's the thing. That comes through on your show quite clear. Like, you know, you're doing this thing, you're putting all this in, but it also becomes very, very clear in the references that you make to all the time that, you know, it's not just Vinnie Eastwood. You actually are working with someone that gives you... You've got a good support basis, and you're very lucky because you've got someone in your corner that believes in you, which, you know, must make it a lot easier to do for what you're doing, because otherwise, you know, you must feel sometimes like the kind of... you know, something like a Kevin Costner character in some movie that goes on for far too long.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes it feels like that anyway, but at the end of the day, she doesn't listen to my radio show invariably. she doesn't like my voice. My bandmate, Mikhail, is here today, and we're going to be hopefully recording some music after the show, She hates my music so much that literally there's like two walls separating my office from here in the bedroom, and even if I'm playing my music in my office really slowly, she can hate it that much that she'll actually get out of bed at 1 o'clock in the morning to come in and tell me to shut it. But shut that shit off, buddy.
it's quite interesting. So, you know,
it's not all supportive, but at the end of the day, she's here to do for me what I can't do for myself. For the most part, like for the first 5 years or so, before I got enough subscribers and listener support so that I can support myself, she was supporting me, and now she had the confidence because I was getting in a decent amount of donations to survive on. She felt the confidence that she could quit her slave job and start her own gardening business.
Oh, sweet.
The problem is she did it during winter when there is the least amount of gardening work available. So I've I've been I'm supporting her on an activist budget.
It's funny what you're saying about the music, because, like, you know, normally the way that the format goes of this show is that we do interlace it with a lot of local music, so that we give people interesting things to hear about, then we provide them with the music so that we don't just sort of wear them actually out. Although in your case, you've got so much to say, which is why I'm letting you do this. But what I also think is, for me, is about, to me, it's about personally using the music so that I can A, find some levity in what I'm doing and something that will just take away a lot of the pressure, but B, also it's a way of helping me translate to my audience. And this is what I think when it comes to activism, we're starting to do this a lot more down in Dunedin, is it's the concept of the fun revolution. You've got to make people enjoy what they're doing to be passionate about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, but at the end of the day, what's real annoying is when people criticise me, like, because I do go on angry rants and stuff like that, and it puts some people off. But at the end of the day, it's the blimmin' truth. And guess what my most popular videos are? My angry rants, because people love that stuff. Even if those people who think that the world is all ethereal, fluffy, happy place, and that by writing a few documents or having a few public meetings, they're going to change things, really change things. No, you're not going to, okay? You need to take full spectrum responsibility for what is going on in your society in every single way that matters. And anything that you ignore, that will be the thing that kills you.
Yeah, that's a true statement said in there. Where do you think, okay, crystal ball time, from someone that has grabbed the bull by the horn and looked at issues a lot deeper than maybe a lot of other people have, where do you think New Zealand's going to be in the next 5 years?
Bottom of the ocean.
Bottom of the ocean.
Drowning in a sea of scumbaggery.
Well, that's interesting about the corruption issue beforehand. Like, in New Zealand, we have, according to Transparency International, we have we're the world's least corrupt country in the world. I'm going to finish this one off,
because
we get a zero rating. But what most, and this gets dragged out by journalists all the time, but what they never report is the reason why we get a zero rating is that we don't fill in the forms. We send them back empty. That's why we get zero.
Yeah, and we're top three least corrupt countries in the world. Other two is Finland, which only allows 500 immigrants per year, and the other one is Singapore, which is run by one guy and his family. Obviously, there's no corruption.
Oh, no corruption. Nothing to see. Move along. It is interesting, though, like, when I put out my book in 99, the first one, like, a lot of the issues which I was dealing with, which was, fairly not that outrageous, saying that there was underage prostitution in New Zealand, there was an organised, very large organised crime presence, that New Zealanders were involved in the mercenary scene. Back then, in 1999, most of my contemporaries were saying to me, no, that doesn't happen, that's all bullshit, that's conspiracy theory. Today, in the age of 2000, most of what I've written about now is just taken as normal. And so I find myself, but yet we still hang on to this fairy myth that there's no corruption in New Zealand. There's no real need for investigations of our government agencies, local and international. Yet, it just seems to be getting worse every time you look at the newspapers. It's getting worse and worse and worse. But we still pretend that it's all fine down here, Trev.
Oh yeah, well, everybody's been lulled into this false sense of complacency. And look, quit your job, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody who's listening right now, if you quit your job today, and start doing something right by humanity, I can guarantee you, every bit of money that you need will show up. Every bit of clothing you need will show up. You know, I haven't worn any new threads in like 6 or 7 years, Ben. I'm wearing hand-me-downs from other activists who've donated me clothing and stuff like
You're
that.
You're getting hand-me-downs from activists. Oh, that paints such a great picture of your fashion sense.
And I actually look pretty damn slick.
You do. I've seen the videos.
In fact, I split my dress pants yesterday, bending down to pick up the signs that I brought to the bloody GCSB protest. So I don't know where I'm going to get a new pair of pants from, but frag it, I'll just go out on the bloody protest, ass hanging out if I need to. But Oh,
I'd be careful about you, but you don't know where the GCSB might be looking up your keyhole.
Okay. In the CIA, there's a CIA document that came out in the 1950s or mid-60s or something like that. And it's a document that explains how we're going to discredit and demonize people who find out what we're really up to. And this word conspiracy theorist comes up. And they say, what we're going to do is anybody who exposes anything that's going on that's the truth, we're going to call them a conspiracy theorist in order to discredit them and make people think that they're crazy for exposing what's really going on.
Well,
and then the first person in a public office to use this term was Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When Woodward and Bernstein were exposing him over the Watergate affair, he called them conspiracy theorists. And then he was later found to be guilty of being part of
a conspiracy.
Okay. Now, here's my definition of a conspiracy theorist. A person who believes, absolutely believes, that powerful people who have a lot of influence actually use their power and influence. I know, it's a stretch of the imagination.
Crazy. Well, that's just out. You're a loony. How dare you think that?
I'm freaking nuts. You know, we're talking about the real fringe shit here, bro. And, if you're not a conspiracy theorist, on the other side of the spectrum, there is a coincidence theorist who thinks that everything happens by sheer coincidence. There's no such thing as lies. There's no such thing as bribery. There's no such thing as backroom deals. There's no such thing as deception. Which of those two people sounds the most naive and insane?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, at yesterday's conference, Aaron Hawkins, who's the Meal candidate for the Green Party, turned around and he opens a statement and it went down like a lead balloon. Oh, you know, it's not often that the conspiracy theorists get to be proven right. And I find myself going, well, which history book have you been reading? Because, you know, my understanding of history is most of the time groups of people do get together to conspire to put forward pursuits and interests of the few over the many. I would say that, you know, history is full of what's actually only happened now is that because of people like Kim.com who actually have the money to fund some of the people that are actually the information that's now coming to light, that's why, you know, this is all coming out. And also, as this information is coming out, people are going, actually, this relates to me and I object to it. So it's not so much a case of, oh, they've only just been proven right. Now things are getting to a stage where people can A, relate to it, and B, as they start to sort of see things, you know, how it's going to impact upon them personally in terms of their own fiscal and returns and their own lifestyles, they're starting to set up and pay because they know they need to listen to this. Beforehand, it's been so much easier to go, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. I'll just go back to my 9-to-5 job and I won't have to think about that because it doesn't have any importance or relate to me at all.
Yeah, essentially, that's the case, isn't it? It's quite sad, really. But, you know, who ever said that the world was a sane place? And so naturally, the people who are accused of being insane, like conspiracy theorists, are actually the ones who are correct. And in fact, there's an article written by a researcher, and I'm not sure if it was Mark Dice or somebody else, I forget his name, it escapes me, but 33 conspiracy theories that turned out to be true. Okay? Conspiracy theories get proven right all the time. In fact, I would probably wager that there is more truth in conspiracy theories than there is in any other form of media reporting these days. Okay?
I'm pretty certain Princess Diana hasn't been abducted by aliens, though.
Yeah, well, look at it this way. How many road cameras were there to capture her along the route? There were 14. Guess how many of them failed simultaneously on that night?
14. No, that's a very relevant point. I was being a bit facetious there, but what I was trying to get across is that once upon a time in New Zealand's lexicon and language, we understood the word investigative journalism, and people understood that an investigative journalist is someone that comes along with a documentation, can support everything they're saying factually, so that if they get taken into court for defamation or for any other reasons, they can back up what they're doing. This is what I've been doing myself for like nearly two decades now. I've had some of the largest corporations and people like Richard V. Allen, George Bush's defense policy advisor, threaten to take me to court, but when it comes down to it, they always back down because I can back up what I'm saying. I have the documentation. That's not conspiracy theory. That's called investigative journalism. And people need to understand that there is a big world of difference.
Yeah, exactly. As Alex Jones would say, I have the documents. And, it's real funny, actually. We did a radio play for Alex Jones' InfoWars film competition, the Paul Revere film competition.
Yeah.
And I do all the voices in this little radio play kind of thing, you know, like, I do the voice of the mother! And the narrator's Alex Jones, and, you know, one time he kind of goes into a rant and he goes, oh, the cowardly new one of the scum! I'm sorry, I'm ranting. I said I'd go back to your film. And he's like, because all the time he just rants on his radio show, and he's got calls calling in, and he always goes, I'm sorry, I'm ranting. I said I would take your calls. And we've got a blooper reel off of one of the recordings where I say those exact words. I'm sorry, I'm ranting. I said I'd take your calls. And I was listening to Alex Jones the other day, and he starts ranting, and he goes, I'm sorry, I'm ranting. I said I would take your calls.
Well, the accusation of being accused.
Here's the other thing. Emotion. And this is funny. Somebody was telling me the other day that they don't like it when I go out and I speak at public meetings.
You use emotion. You're okay.
Because I'm a rebel. Because I'm a rabble rouser. You know, I get angry. I use emotions and so on and so forth. And you know what's interesting is that those are the ones I usually get the biggest reaction from the crowd. You know why? Because I don't just appeal to their reason with the facts and evidence that I'm outlaying and I'm speaking. I'm actually speaking with real emotion, with real passion, because I'm a real fracking person, and people identify with that, okay? And these other people that say that, oh, but Vinny, you know, your message is going to be lost on so many people. Really? Who's got a website, the top million websites
exactly.
in the world?
And,
me.
And John Pilcher does care, you know, he covers the same issue, which is we've been led up to believe that there's a thing of fair and balanced news reporting where you keep it objective, but in reality, as it's he says, she says, and ultimately they always end up in such a way that the incumbent or the power at the top of the food chain is given more weight. So it's actually, it's not unemotional, it is slanted. Yet, you know, why should you not be able to turn around and report on news from your perspective when that's, you know, that's your authority? You can only speak to people with authority that you have, which
right.
is the viewpoint from where you come from.
Dude came up to me at the Occupy Auckland protest a couple of years back, right? And he says, Vinny, I really love your news because it's not biased. And I said, that's not true. It's very biased. It's just the kind of bias you want.
Well, exactly. And that's my attitude too, is that, you know, I have my own slant, and my attitude, if anyone ever challenges me, it's like, well, I go, look, you know, quite frankly, Stephen Joyce's friends at MediaWorks, you know, they've got millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars of budget. You know, so if you want the other side, just go and watch MediaWorks, because I'm here to cover the other side that's not getting covered.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to cover their side because it's bullshit. Okay, basically that's the end of the day. They can report on whatever they want. They can report about cats stuck down trees. They can report about the royal baby. They can report about frickin' X Factor. They can report all that stuff. You know, good luck to them.
Yes.
Don't give a crap. It's not frickin' relevant. It's not relevant.
And why
in the hell would I ever give coverage to things that aren't freaking important when there are so many important things that don't get any coverage?
Yes, that's right. And meanwhile, in Somalia today, Mrs. Ingabunga had a baby. New Zealand government will not be sending her a present. I just want to quickly go back to, like, because I am intrigued about when you're talking about those 32 conspiracies that have been proven, because, you know, again, in my case, I've been doing what I've been doing for nearly two decades now. I've got a pretty good strike record of coming up with stories that at the time we've been told, oh, no, that can't possibly be true. Then 6 months to 2 years later, you know, then the mainstream catches up with me. But in the cases that you're talking about, just maybe give us the top five that you can recall.
Well, the cases of what? Just in general?
So things that were so-called conspiracies that we now know to actually have actually, you know, they weren't. They were actually factually reported events.
Whew. 9/11 being an inside job? That's a big one. False flag terrorism is certainly right up there. GMO food not being safe at all. That's a really big one.
Well, that's definitely a tick.
The conspiracy of Agenda 21 to control all human life and reduce the human population. and Codex Alimentarius, the conspiracy document from out of the UN to control all food supply around
which is,
the
which
world.
Which is where treaties such as TTP and the MIA all come from as well. So they're all part of this, the other
and,
subparts.
Fluoride. You know,
well, see, the fluoride one intrigues me because, you know, to be really, really honest, it's not something that I have really read in depth. But what I do understand about the fluoride, which I think, you know, the mainstream media misses a point, is, number one, the people themselves should get the right to decide what actually goes into their food or water themselves. That is never actually given a chance. Number two, when they do actually decide to put it in our water, we should actually know where it's been made, what other additives are actually going in with it. So this is about the right to choose your own medicine and the transparency. And regardless of what you think about fluoride, those are the two issues which you cannot argue against, but those issues never get debated.
If you go to your doctor and he gives you a glass or something or a pill or whatever and he says, take it. And you go, what am I taking? He says, don't worry about that. I'm your doctor. Take it. And you go, no, I don't want to take it. You must take it. He'd lose his medical license. But the government can do it.
Oh, entirely. And they do it to us all the time. You know, and it's...
Yeah, I mean, like, you really hit the nail on the head with that one, bro, because it's forced mass medication, which is illegal, okay?
Yeah, with no right to see what's actually happening.
End of freaking argument. Yep. End of argument, okay? That's just one. And you know what the problem is about fluoride? There's about 50 statements that you can make about fluoride where it's the end of argument, end of story, get it out of the water, 50 different facts and stuff that you're going to rattle off on the top of your head. Is the fluoride pharmaceutical grade? No. End of argument, because it's not actually being done for a pharmaceutical purpose.
And the
is
other
fluoride
thing which,
necessary in any way, shape, or form for any part of the body to function? Is it a nutrient? Is it a vitamin? No. End of argument.
Well, you know, another issue which, you know, I'll take that on board with this, the same covers with the issue of vaccination, which is, you know, aside from the fact that whenever you run a story that even challenges the vaccination, you can guarantee that within a week there will be a full-page article from the pharmaceutical companies and the main mainstream paper that just blows out what you've done because, you know, they've got the deep pockets to turn around and make sure that they shout over the top of you. But that was standing.
In his speech to a number of people in Auckland in February this year, he said, that any councillor who gets fluoride out of the water supply will immediately be attacked with editorials and a bunch of ignoramus arguments. And guess what happened when fluoride was taken out of the water in Hamilton? A whole bunch of ignoramus articles and editorials came out and demonised the frag out of them.
And that's called lobbying, and that's the thing that frustrates me. Now, we're going to have to wrap up very shortly, but you know, even when you get to the issue of K2, I do not. Okay. We've got 7 minutes, Vanessa. We're going to wrap this up very, very shortly. My radio station manager is going to come and get me, and that's not a conspiracy. But, you know, when you're dealing with the issue of vaccination, is that there are actual protocols about when you should use vaccinations and how they should be used. They don't even follow their own rule book. And so even when you turn around and you just challenge them on those basics, those are not the issues which get covered in a mainstream. So it doesn't necessarily give people the facts that they need to judge for themselves. And the last thing I want to mention before I let you kind of go out on a quick bit of a last-moment rant is, you know, with the issue about the K2, is even if you don't support K2, which I don't, when I turn around...
I thought it was a mountain.
Well, you know, the synthetic cannabis, but what I'm talking about is when I turn around and see large corporations and lobbyists of the alcohol industry spending large amounts of money to make sure that only one side of the argument is heard, and it is also done in such a way that they very sneakily blend in the use of K2 with all drugs, so they make it all look like you're smoking a joint or it's tied in with a story about cannabis, I get really, really, really suspicious. And in this world of public relations, we need to be much more aware of how much their voice gets heard in our mainstream newsroom. So on that, you know, I'll just let you kind of finish off on that note, maybe kind of comment to that, and then just finish up with, you know, again, your website and how people can listen into your radio show.
All right, well, I just want to cover the vaccines and the synthetic cannabis for a quick moment here. Okay, so vaccines. It's on the printout sheet of the swine flu vaccine that they put out during that big scam, and I love it how the mainstream media had the word pandemic written in blood when they reported that like 146 people had swine flu when regular flu kills down like 1,000 people in this country every year, right? It actually says on the printout sheet of the vaccine, do not give to pregnant women. So what does the government do? Massive advertising campaign. Swine flu vaccine, free for pregnant women.
And that's what I mean. They don't follow their own rule book.
No! Well, the thing is, they wrote the rule book to give themselves double indemnity or whatever, so that they can say, hey, we warned you. What is it? You warned me against this thing that you're promoting and you didn't tell me explicitly what it was. You told me it was good for me, even though what the document says is that it's not good for me. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly.
That protects you? That means you're honest because you didn't get caught in a lie?
Well, see, hopefully in the future we're going to have a guy on the show, Professor Craig Shaw from British Columbia University, and he actually, he studied vaccine and is a scientist, so his viewpoints are going to be very interesting because he's going to bring up all these issues, and he's not anti-vaccination, he's just saying, hey, this is what's happening, and it's actually against our own rule book. K2, comments on K2 and the great K2, pitchforks and burning flames.
Now, has K2 technically yet killed anybody?
Well, as far as I'm aware, technically it hasn't. I mean, I could run a show on this alone. It is a nasty
alcohol
thing.
Alcohol definitely killed some people.
Every weekend and every single crime page, you'll find alcohol is 75 to 80% of the causes on the crime page.
Yeah, 78-80% of weekend crime caused by alcohol. Has marijuana in 10,000 years of recorded usage ever killed anybody?
Yes, there has. At one stage, there was 200 pounds dropped on someone from a 42-story building.
And also, people get shot in the back running away from the cops. Okay? It's a false argument. And what I loved is my friend Arik Reese, who I've had on the show, is making a new documentary called Drug Lord, LAWED. If you go search Drug Lord on YouTube, I really respect him. He's got a lot of talent as a filmmaker, and he's collated so much interviews.
And we're going to have to wrap this up, mate. We've got two minutes to get this done, and we must do this. Otherwise, the our station manager will come in like the wrath of God on me.
Okay.
And only because that's what he does, and he's a very good station manager. Oh, you really are.
Well, station managers have to manage. All right, and...
So, Vinny, how do we find you?
Okay, yeah, how do we find you? Let's get
the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's actually the Vinny Eastwood, T-H-E. Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead.
Make my day, my news.
And also, most important, is the YouTube channel.
Mr. News.
Mr. News, Gorilla Media. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to listen to the country's most popular, most published, and most followed,
then we'll have to go to the Vinny Eastwood show. And at that point, Vinny, I'm going to have to say goodbye and thank you very much for coming into the show. Hopefully, we'll bring you back in about a few months, I think, because it's just a really joy to talk to you. But on that note, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon for listening to Ricky Lind, Ben Vigen, and today Vinny Eastwood from The Postman Show, www.postmanproductions.org. Good afternoon and